Random House Audiobooks presents Tom Clancy's Opcenter, Games of State. Created by Tom Clancy and Steve Pachenik. Read for you by John Rubenstein.
Games of State. Thursday, 9:47 a.m. Until a few days ago, 21-year-old Jody Thompson didn't have a war. Back in 1991, the young girl had been too preoccupied with boys to pay much attention to the Persian Gulf War. Vietnam belonged to her parents, and all she knew about Korea was that the veterans had finally gotten a memorial. World War II was her grandparents' war. Yet, oddly enough, she was coming to know it best of all. 5 days before, Jody had left behind her sobbing parents and flown from Rockville Center, Long Island, to Germany to intern on the feature film Tirpitz. Until she sat down on the plane with a script, Jody knew almost nothing about Adolf Hitler, the Third Reich, or the Axis. Now and then, her grandfather said something respectful about Truman, whose A-bomb saved him from being butchered in a prison camp in Thailand, a camp where he'd once bitten the ear of a man who was torturing him. When Jody asked her grandfather why he'd done that, didn't it only make the torture worse, the gentle man had replied, "Sometimes you just have to do what you have to do." Now Jody was taking a crash course in the chaos that had engulfed the world. Since she'd come to the set, Jody had seen the powerful script come to life. Today, by a cottage in Garbsen, outside Hanover, she had watched the cast film scenes in which a disgraced former SA officer leaves his family to exonerate himself on the German battleship Tirpitz. She had seen the gripping special effects footage of the attack by RAF Lancasters, which had capsized the battleship in Tromsøfjord, Norway, in 1944, entombing 1,000 crew members. And here, in the prop trailer, she touched actual pieces of the war. Jody still found it difficult to believe that such madness had taken place, even though the evidence was spread on the tables before her. It was an unprecedented array of vintage medals, lanyards, weapons, and memorabilia on loan from private collectors. Oil could stain the relics, so the tall, slender brunette wiped her hands on her blouse before picking up the authentic Sturmabteilungen dagger she'd come for. Her large, dark eyes shifted from the silver-tipped brown metal sheath to the brown hilt. In a circle near the top were the silver letters S.A. Below them were a German eagle and a swastika. She slowly withdrew the 9-inch weapon and examined it. It was heavy and horrible. Jody wondered how many lives it had ended.
"Thompson, the knife!"
Director Larry Langford's high voice ripped Jody from her reflection. She pushed the dagger back into the sheath and hurried to the trailer door. She jumped down the steps, rushed past the guard, and ran around the trailer. While the director showed his actor how to hand the dagger to his son, Jody walked back to the trailer. The elderly German guard, Mr. Buba, smiled at Jody as she climbed the steps. Upon reaching the doorway, Jody stopped suddenly and peered into the distance. "Mr. Buba, I think I saw someone moving around in the woods. They aren't in the shot yet, but I'd hate to be them if they ruin one of Langford's takes." Buba pulled the walkie-talkie from its belt strap.
"I don't know how they could have gotten through, but I'll have someone check on it."
As he radioed in the report, Jody returned to the trailer. Paul Hood awoke with a start as the big jet thumped down on runway 2 at the Hamburg International Airport. The lean, 43-year-old director of the op center was stiff and sore after 8 hours in the coach seat. But, cramped as Hood had been, at least he felt rested. Bob Herbert was right. The secret to sleeping on airplanes was silence, and the earplugs had worked perfectly. Hood frowned as he sat up straight. "We've come to Germany at the invitation of Deputy Foreign Minister Hausen to look at millions of dollars of high-tech equipment. And 50 cents worth of Brooklyn-made silicone makes me a happy man." There had to be a moral in that. Hood removed the plugs and leaned toward Matt Stoll, OpCenter's portly operations support officer, was sitting in the aisle seat to Hood's right. He was just removing his headphones.
Good morning,
Stoll said as he stuffed the headphones in the seat back. He looked at his watch, then turned his big Cupid doll face toward Hood.
We're 25 minutes early,
he said in his precise, clipped tones. Hood glanced past Stoll. Across the aisle, the gray-haired intelligence officer said in his high southern drawl,
How'd the earplugs work for you, Chief?
Fantastic, said Hood. I was asleep before we passed Halifax. The seatbelt sign was turned off and everyone rose except Herbert. As people collected their carry-on luggage, he leaned his head back, his eyes fixed on the overhead reading light. It had been more than 10 years since he'd lost the use of his legs in the Beirut embassy bombing, and Hood knew he was still self-conscious about not being able to walk. Though no one who worked with Herbert gave his handicap a thought, Herbert didn't like to make eye contact with strangers. Herbert disliked pity. After the door was opened and the aisle had emptied, a German flight attendant came over with an airline wheelchair. Herbert's customized chair, with its cellular phone and built-in laptop, had been sent along as baggage. With his powerful arms, Herbert lifted himself over the armrest and dropped into the leather seat. As Hood and Stoll fell in behind, toting their carry-ons, he led the way through the cabin, wheeling himself. The heat of the Hamburg summer permeated the passenger bridge, but it was mild compared to what they'd left behind in Washington, D.C. They entered the bustling, air-conditioned terminal, where the flight attendant turned them over to a government official whom the German businessman Martin Lang had sent to help them through customs. Werner Dagover's lip curled with disgust when he rounded the hill and saw the woman sitting behind the tree.
Well, that was fine work by the road team, he thought, letting someone through. It's true, Werner reflected, great evil was committed during the 12-year Reich, but in purging everything from the past, we've also cast out discipline, the work ethic, and too many other virtues.
But these things mattered to Werner Dagover. After notifying the dispatcher that there was a woman in the woods, Werner shut off his walkie-talkie. As Werner neared the tree, the slender young woman rose and turned. She was tall, with aristocratic cheekbones, a strong nose, and eyes that seemed like liquid gold in the direct sunlight. She was wearing a loose white blouse, jeans, and black boots.
Hello,
she said breathlessly.
Miss, Werner said, a film is being shot just round the hill, and we must keep the area clear. If you'll come with me, I can escort you back to the main road.
Of course, I'm sorry.
She reached behind the tree.
Let me just get my backpack.
Werner heard leaves rustle above him. He looked up, in time to see two men dressed in green and wearing ski masks jump from the lowest branch. The smaller man landed in front of him, holding a Walther P-38. Werner couldn't see the larger man who dropped behind him.
Don't speak, the gunman told Werner. Just give us your uniform.
Werner's eyes shifted to the woman as she removed a folding stock Uzi from the backpack. Then she looked from Werner to the man behind him. She nodded once. Werner Dagover gasped as the man slipped 2 feet of copper wire around his throat and pulled tight. The last thing he felt was a rippling of pain which girdled his neck and shot down his spine. Short, powerfully built Rolf Murnau of Dresden, in what was formerly East Germany, stood at ease beside the oak. The 19-year-old was armed and attentive as he watched the hill that lay between them and the film set. Every now and then, Rolf turned to make sure no one approached from the road. Karin Döring finished removing Werner's uniform while the hulking Manfred Piper put it on. Karin picked up her Uzi, slipped it in the backpack, and walked to where Manfred was standing. The 34-year-old wasn't as driven or well-read as his companion, but he was devoted to her.
Let's go, she said impatiently.
Putting his big hand around Karin's arm, Manfred, the co-founder of Foyer, led her toward the set. When they were gone, Rolf turned and jogged back toward the main road to wait for them. Thursday, 3:04 a.m., Washington, D.C. As he looked at the short stack of comic books on his bed, General Mike Rogers wondered what the hell had happened to Innocence. The 45-year-old deputy director of Op Center had awakened at 2 a.m. and had been unable to get back to sleep. Since the death of Lieutenant Colonel W. Charles Squires on a mission with his Stryker commandos, Rogers had spent night after night replaying the Russian incursion in his mind. Rather than lie in bed and mourn, Rogers had driven from his home to the local 7-Eleven. He would be going to see gangly Billy Squires in the morning and wanted to bring him something. Comic books seemed like a good bet. Charles's kid liked superheroes. But what bothered him was that he couldn't tell the comic book good guys from the bad guys. Superman had long hair and a mean temper. Rogers absently rubbed his high-ridged nose, then switched off the light and lay on his belly. He knew he couldn't afford to surrender to sorrow. There was a widow and her son to think about, plus the sad task of finding a new commander for Stryker. And he had to run Op Center for the rest of the week that Paul Hood would be in Europe. And today was going to be a low point on the job, what Op Center's attorney Lowell Coffey II accurately described as the welcoming of the fox to the warren. Jody's mouth twisted as she entered the trailer and took a look at the prop list.
Great, she said under her breath. Just great.
The item she needed was hanging in the tiny bathroom of the prop trailer. Getting to it around the clutter of tables and trunks would require delicate maneuvering. Jody sidled her way to the lavatory. There was a heavy trunk and a heavier table beside it, and she could only open the door part way. She managed to squeeze in and began flipping through the 40-odd garment bags, looking at the tags on each. Mr. Booba turned as he heard the voices from behind the trailer.
I'm one of those people who never has any luck, a woman was saying. If I go to a store, it's right after a movie star has been there. If I'm at a restaurant, it's the day before a celebrity dines there.
Mr. Booba shook his head. He felt sorry for the young woman. Werner was a stickler for the rules, but maybe they could bend them so the poor lady could see a movie star.
Werner, since this woman is already our guest, why don't we...
Mr. Booba didn't get to finish his sentence. Manfred swung Werner's billy club. The black wood crashed lengthwise against Mr. Booba's right temple. He slid to the ground and sat there, leaning against the trailer. Manfred opened the door of the cab, then climbed in. As he did, a man from the film crew shouted,
Jody!
Karin faced away from the set. She knelt, pulled off her backpack, and slipped out her Uzi. The man began walking toward the trailer. A confident pop-pop-pop from the Uzi dropped the man on his back. The moment he hit the ground, people began screaming and running. The trailer's powerful engine growled to life.
Let's go!
Manfred yelled to Karin as he shut the door of the cab. The young woman walked backward toward the open door of the trailer itself. Expressionless, she jumped in, pulled up the collapsible stairs, and closed the door. As Manfred roared off through the woods, Mr. Booba's dead body flopped lifelessly to the ground. Jean-Michel Orne thought it fitting that his meeting with the leader, the self-proclaimed new Führer, was taking place in the St. Pauli district of Hamburg, always known as a district of sin. The Frenchman had left his two traveling companions asleep in the room and caught a taxi outside his hotel on An der Alster. Jean-Michel pushed back his thick black hair. Tall and slightly overweight, the 43-year-old executive vice president of Demain was looking forward to meeting Richter. The few who knew him agreed on two things. First, Richter was dedicated to his cause. That was good. Monsieur Dominique and the rest of the French team were dedicated people as well. Second, people said that Richter was a man of wild, sudden extremes. He could embrace you or decapitate you, as whimsy dictated. In that respect, Richter appeared to have much in common with his own shadowy employer. Napoleon and Hitler were the same way. Jean-Michel Orne walked up to the black metal door at the front of Richter's club, Ausweichsein. The Frenchman pressed the button and waited. Ausweichsein, or substitute, was one of the most infamous, decadent, and successful night spots in St. Pauli. A moment later, the door opened and a bodybuilder motioned Jean-Michel in. The big man shut and locked the door and patted him down thoroughly. After a minute or two, Jean-Michel heard footsteps, and Felix Richter stepped into the red light of the bar. Jean-Michel recognized the dapper 32-year-old from the photographs he had seen. He was dressed in an impeccably tailored suit, highly polished shoes, and a black tie with red stripes. More impressive than Richter's attire, however, were his eyes. Once they found their target, they didn't move. Richter did not seem the kind of man to avert his eyes from anyone.
"It was good of you to come," Richter said. "Yet I thought that your employer would be visiting as well. As you know, Monsieur Dominique prefers to conduct business from his factory. With the technology available to him, there's very little reason to leave."
"I understand," said Richter. "Never photographed, rarely seen, appropriately mysterious. Monsieur Dominique has sent me to represent him in these discussions, and also to be his eyes and ears during chaos days." Monsieur Dominique owned a billion-dollar manufacturing company and controlled one of the most powerful right-wing groups in France, in the world. Richter led Jean-Michel to a table and switched on a lamp in the center. Jean-Michel sat down when Richter did. The man had made a fortune from this club and from a hostess service he operated in Berlin, Stuttgart, Frankfurt, and Hamburg.
"We understand you have an apartment here, Herr Richter." "I do," Richter said, "though I only stay here one or two nights a week. I spend most of my time at the 21st Century National Socialist Party suites in Bergedorf, to the south. That's where the real work of the movement is done."
"Herr Richter..." Jean-Michel leaned forward and folded his hands on the table.
"I'm here with a proposition. It is not commonly known, but Monsieur Dominique has been quietly underwriting neo-Nazi groups around the world. The Razorheads in England, the Soldiers of Poland, and the Whites-Only Association in America. He is trying to build a worldwide network of organizations with a common goal of ethnic purity.
Together with his new Jacobins," Richter said, "that would put his strength at some 6,000 members.
Close to that, yes. And when he goes online in America, those numbers are sure to increase."
"Almost certainly," agreed Richter. "I've seen copies of his games. They're most entertaining."
"What Monsieur Dominique proposes, Herr Richter, is bringing your 21st century organization into the fold. He will provide you with funds, access to demain technology, and a role in shaping the future of the world."
"And why should I accept a part in Dominique's drama when I can direct my own play?"
"Because Monsieur Dominique has resources the likes of which you can only dream of. And he can offer you both political and personal protection."
"Protection from whom?" Richter asked. "The government won't touch me again. The 2 years I was in prison made me a martyr to the cause, and my people are devoted."
"There are other leaders, other potential new Führers. There's been talk that Karin Döring and Feuer are the rising stars of the movement."
Jean-Michel knew that Felix Richter and Karin Döring had been outspoken adversaries 2 years before, when Karin came out of East Germany espousing terrorism, while Richter, fresh from prison, was advocating political activism. There was still tension between the unvarnished East German guerrilla and the dapper West German physician.
"Monsieur Dominique believes that either of you would make a potent ally, which is why he has instructed me to talk with her as well."
Richter stood. "I will come for you at your hotel at 5:30 tonight. She and I will both be appearing at tonight's rally in Hanover. Then you will see for yourself who leads and who follows. Until then, good morning."
Jean-Michel rose.
"I have been instructed to report to Monsieur Dominique this morning, not this evening. What do I tell him about his offer?"
"I respect Dominique, but unlike you, Monsieur Horn, I do not have to kowtow. He wants my help. I do not need his."
"This man is preposterous," Jean-Michel thought.
"You will excuse me," he said.
"No,"
Richter said quietly. "I will not. You do not walk out when I am facing you."
The Frenchman glared at him for a moment, then turned anyway. He ran into the doorman. The big man grabbed Jean-Michel's neck and turned him around so he was facing Richter.
"Richter, are you insane?"
Jean-Michel cried.
"Irrelevant," Richter replied. "I'm in command."
"Don't you know that Monsieur Dominique will hear of this?"
Richter's arm moved up. There was a knife in his hand. It stopped less than a quarter inch from Jean-Michel's left eye. Then he raised the knife so it was pointing straight toward the Frenchman's eyeball. Despite his anger, the Frenchman felt his insides weaken and liquefy. Richter glared at him.
You speak to me as if you were my equal. What have you done in your life other than to ride a visionary's rocket? When you were hired by Demain, you adopted Dominique's world view. But devoted servants are replaceable.
Richter angled the knife so it was point up. Jean-Michel tried to back away, but the man behind him held him steady. Richter moved the blade higher until the tip was under the upper eyelid. Jean-Michel was panting. He felt a prick above the eyeball.
Please, no, he sobbed. Mon Dieu, Herr Richter.
Slowly, the German brought his left hand toward the knife. He placed his palm against the bottom of the hilt as though he were going to jam it up. He pushed the knife gently upwards. The prick became a shooting pain that punched against the back of Jean-Michel's forehead. Jean-Michel screamed. Richter twisted the knife again, drawing another scream.
In the very near future, Dominique will need me far more than I need him. His new computer programs will be downloaded in American cities, but they can persuade only over time. I and my lieutenants can go to America, meet with and inspire American Nazis. We are people of the fatherland, the home of the movement. And that, Monsieur Horn, makes me Dominique's superior.
Richter smiled, and a moment later let the knife fall into his palm. He stepped back. Jean-Michel moaned, a combination of pain and relief.
So, Richter said, when you contact Dominique, tell him that I've given you a lesson in humility. You can also tell him that no one, not Karen Doring or anyone else, will ever lead the movement in Germany. That is my destiny. Have we any other business?
The doorman relaxed his grip enough so that Jean-Michel could shake his head.
Excellent, Richter said as he turned. Ewald will call you a taxi and give you a minute to collect yourself. I trust I will see you tonight. It will be an evening to remember.
The ride from the airport to the city center on the Autobahn took 35 minutes. As always, when he traveled on business, Hood wished that he had time to stop and look at some of the buildings, monuments, and museums they passed. But even if there had been time, Hood wasn't sure he'd be comfortable taking it. His devotion to duty was one of the qualities which had earned him the sobriquet Pope Paul at Op Center. He didn't know for sure, but he suspected that the nickname had been coined by Op Center's press officer, Anne Ferris. Hood felt a curious sadness for himself and for Anne. The young divorcee barely concealed her affection for Paul, and when they worked alone together, he felt dangerously close. There was an intoxicating, seductive pull to which it would have been easy to succumb. But he was married, with two young children, and he wasn't going to leave them. True, he didn't love making love to his wife anymore. Sharon Kent was a mommy. She was a cable TV personality, and she was older and more tired and not as hungry for him as she'd been. Of course, he had to admit that in the flesh, he wasn't the knight he'd once been either, except in Anne's eyes, which was why he found himself getting drawn into them now and then. Still, he and Sharon had built memories together. But Lord God, Hood thought sadly, what I wouldn't give for a night of what was. The Alsterhof Hotel was situated between the city's two spectacular lakes, though Hood, Stoll, and Herbert barely had time to check in and wash up before heading back downstairs. Bob Herbert, the intelligence officer, glanced out the windows while Matt Stoll, the operations support officer, did a quick electronic sweep to make sure the room hadn't been bugged.
We got a pretty nice view, huh?
Herbert said as they rode the elevator down. He was absently twirling an 18-inch long section of broom handle he kept under the wheelchair's left armrest for protection. He also kept a 2-inch Urban Skinner knife tucked under the right armrest. As they made their way through the crowded lobby, Hood looked around for Martin Lang and Deputy Foreign Minister Richard Hausen. He had never met Hausen, but he was anxious to see the German electronics tycoon Lang again. They had spent some time together when, as mayor of Los Angeles, Hood had hosted a dinner for international guests at a computer convention. When it came time to price the construction of the new brainchild of Mike Rogers and Matt Stoll, the Regional Op Center, or ROC, Lang was the first person who came to mind for the computers they'd need. They stopped near the house phones, away from the flow of guests. Hood took in the thick, curious mix of smartly dressed business people and casual tourists. The golden hair flashed at him from the front door. It captured his eye, not because of the movement itself, but because of the way it moved. As the woman left the lobby, her head cocked right, and the long blonde hair snapped left, fast and confident. Hood was transfixed. The woman disappeared to the right. For a long instant, he didn't blink, couldn't breathe.
"Chief?" Stoll asked. "You see him?"
Hood didn't answer. He bolted toward the door and rushed through. He looked to the right.
"Taxi?" asked the liveried doorman.
"Did a woman just get in that cab?" Hood asked.
"Yeah."
"Do you know her? Is she a guest here?"
"Nein, she dropped off a package and left."
Hood pointed a thumb to the lobby. "Dropped it off in there?"
"Not at the desk," said the doorman. "She gave it to someone."
Hood was staring at the curb, fighting a storm of emotions.
"You shoved off like a guy whose dog ran onto the highway,"
Matt Stoll said.
"You okay?"
Hood nodded.
"Yeah, I'm convinced,"
Bob Herbert lied. "No, really," Hood said distantly. Never mind. It's a long story." Hood reached into his pocket and gave the doorman a $10 bill. "If she happens to come back, tell her that Paul..." "No, just try and find out who she is."
"Yeah,"
said the doorman appreciatively. Hood couldn't decide whether he'd walked into a dream or a nightmare. As the men stood there, a black stretch limousine pulled up. The doorman dashed over and a stocky, silver-haired man emerged. He and Hood saw each other at the same time.
"Herr Hood,"
Martin Lang said with a wave and a big, genuine smile. He came forward with short, quick strides, his hand extended.
"It's wonderful to see you again. You look very, very well."
"Washington suits me better than Los Angeles." Though Hood was looking at Lang, he was still seeing the woman. The shift of the head, the blaze of hair.
"Stop it,"
he yelled at himself. "You have a job to do, and you have a life." As Hood introduced his associates, a tall, blonde, distinguished-looking man in his middle 40s emerged from the car. He walked over slowly.
"Herr Hood," said Lang as the man arrived, "allow me to introduce Richard Hausen."
"Welcome to Hamburg,"
Hausen said. His voice was resonant and refined, his English impeccable. He greeted each man personally with a handshake and a little bow.
"He reminds me of Dracula," whispered Stoll.
Hood tended to ignore Stoll's frequent under-the-breath comments, though this one was near the mark. Hausen was dressed in a black suit. His face was pale but intense, and he exuded a distinctive old-world courtliness. But from what Hood had read before leaving, Dracula's nemesis, Dr. von Helsing, would have been more accurate for this man. Instead of prowling for vampires, Richard Hausen hunted neo-Nazis. Op Center's staff psychologist Liz Gordon described him as having a Captain Ahab-like hatred of right-wing radicals. For now, Hausen's presence at the meeting was an indication of just how much the German electronics industry wanted to do business with the U.S. government. Martin Lang led them to the limousine and what he promised would be the finest authentic German meal in Hamburg. The noontime lunch was early by German standards, and the restaurant was empty. They did not discuss the ROC during the meal. That would take place later in Hausen's Hamburg office. Toward the end of the meal, Hausen's cellular telephone chirped. He pulled it from his jacket pocket, excused himself, and half turned to answer. His bright eyes dulled, and his thin lips turned down. He said very little. When the call was finished, Hausen laid the phone on the table.
"That was my assistant," he said.
He looked from Lang to Hood.
"There's been a terrorist attack on a movie location outside Hanover. 3 people are dead. An American girl is missing, and there's reason to believe she has been kidnapped."
Lang grew ashen.
"The movie, was it Tirpitz?"
Richard Hausen nodded. The deputy foreign minister was obviously upset. Herbert asked,
"Did I know who did it?"
No one has claimed credit, Hausen said, but the shooting was done by a woman.
Doring,
Lang said. He looked from Hausen to Herbert.
This can only be Karin Doring, the leader of Feuer. It means fire. They're one of the most violent neo-Nazi groups in Germany. She recruits young savages from the East and trains them herself.
Why attack a movie set? Hood asked. It was an American and German production, Hausen said. That's reason enough for Doring. She wants all foreigners out of Germany. But the terrorists also stole a trailer filled with Nazi memorabilia. Medals, weapons, uniforms, and the like.
Sentimental bastards,
Herbert said. Perhaps, said Hausen. Or they may want it for something else. You see, gentlemen, there's an abhorrent phenomenon several years old called Chaos Days. Hate groups from all over Germany, and even from other nations, converge in Hanover, 100 kilometers south of here. They have rallies and exchange their sick ideas and literature. Some, including Doring's group, have made it a tradition of attacking symbolic as well as strategic targets during this time. Herbert said,
And the government doesn't crack down on Chaos Days for fear of creating martyrs?
Many people in the government are afraid of that, yes, Hausen said. They are afraid of the increasingly open pride many otherwise right-thinking Germans have for what the nation, galvanized and mobilized under Hitler, was able to accomplish. During Chaos Days in particular, when so many antagonistic elements are out in force, the government treads carefully.
And you think this Karin Doring or whoever wanted the memorabilia for Chaos Days? Herbert asked.
Passing out those mementos would tie recipients directly to the Reich, Hausen said, thinking aloud. Imagine how that would motivate each and every one of them. Lang said,
Or the theft might swell the hearts of those who read about it in the newspapers. Men and women who, as Richard said, still privately revere Hitler.
Bob Herbert gave Hood a look. Hood thought for a moment, then nodded.
Excuse me, Herbert said.
He wheeled himself from the table and patted the telephone on his armrest.
I'm going to find myself a nice, quiet corner and make some calls. Maybe we can add a little something to the intelligence pool.
Lang rose and thanked him, then apologized again. Herbert assured him that there was nothing to apologize for.
I lost my wife and my legs to terrorists in Beirut. Each time they show their sick faces, it gives me a chance to hunt more of them down.
Herbert swung himself around and wheeled his way through the tables. With his departure, Hausen sat and tried to collect himself. Hood looked at him. Something else was going on here. We've been fighting this battle for over 50 years, Hausen said gravely. You can inoculate against disease and seek shelter from a storm. But how do you protect yourself from hate? And it's a growth business, Herr Hood. Every year there are more groups with more members. God help us if they ever unite. They're very well hidden, extremely well armed, and quite impossible to infiltrate. We rarely know in advance what they are planning.
Only for now, Matt told him.
Lang looked at him.
What do you mean, Herr Storm?
You know that backpack I left in the car?
Hausen and Lang both nodded. Stoll smiled.
Well, if we can all get together on this ROC thing, we're going to blow a lot of rotten slices right out of the bread box.
When Jody Thompson heard the shouts outside the trailer, she thought the director was calling for her. Then she heard the gunfire. Then the trailer engine roared, the door slammed, and she heard someone moving around inside. Suddenly, the bathroom seemed very warm and close. Noticing that the door wasn't locked, she gingerly lifted the bolt and threw it. She backed against the wall away from the door. Her heart was punching up against her jaw. The intruder was coming toward the bathroom. Jody looked up, around, behind her. She saw the frosted glass of the window, but because of the metal bars, no one could get in, or now, out. Jody hunkered down low behind the swaying clothes, then crept back beside the toilet with a tiny shower stall door to her rear. A burst of gunfire drowned out the sound of her heart. She screamed as wood and plastic chips flew from the door. Then the door squeaked outward, and a gun barrel pushed through the row of German uniforms. It pushed them to the side, and a face peered down at her. A woman's face. The woman motioned up with a gun, and Jody stood. She said something in German.
I
don't understand, Jody said. I said, pick up your hands and turn around, the woman barked in English. Jody raised her hands, then hesitated. She had read about how hostages were often shot in the back of the head. Please, I'm an intern. I was assigned to this movie. Turn. Please don't, Jody said, even as she did what she was told. Jody felt the warm metal of the gun against the top of her neck. Please, she sobbed. Jody started as the woman patted her left side from breast to thigh and then her right. Then she turned Jody around. The gun was pointing toward her mouth. Jody knew that she would do anything this woman told her. The van stopped suddenly, and Jody stumbled toward the sink. The trailer door opened, and a young man walked over. He had a pale complexion. Without taking her eyes off Jody, Karin turned slightly toward the young man and said, Begin. The man started loading the relics into the trunks. Karin continued to stare at Jody.
I don't like killing women, but I cannot take hostages. They slow me down.
That was it. Jody was going to die. She went numb. She began to sob. Every scrap of confidence and accomplishment and dignity flooded away. But instead of shooting her, the woman ordered another man, an older man, to remove the uniforms. Then she closed the bathroom door. Instead of gunfire, all Jody heard was a scraping sound. Something had been pushed against the door. The three hijackers finished quickly in the trailer and then were gone. Jody listened. One of the hijackers was outside the window. Something metal was turning, followed by clanking, and she smelled gas. The fuel tank, she thought with horror. They've opened it.
No!
Jody screamed as she threw herself against the door. A moment later, she smelled smoke, heard footsteps running from the van, and saw the orange of the flame reflected against the frosted glass of the window. The girl threw herself against the door. It wouldn't budge. And as the orange grew brighter, she stood in the middle of the small room, screaming with fear and despair. It was 6 hours earlier in Washington, D.C., and Liz Gordon, OpCenter's staff psychologist, had just finished grinding up coffee beans when her cellular phone rang.
Liz, it's Bob Herbert. A bunch of neo-Nazis attacked a movie set. It appears the group was led by a woman named Karin Doering. Heard of her? The name is familiar.
Liz took the phone from the kitchen and began walking toward the study.
Give me a second and I'll see what we've got.
She switched on the computer, sat down, and accessed the database in her office at OpCenter. In less than 10 seconds, the file on Doering had been downloaded.
She describes herself as a Nazi Robin Hood, striking a blow for the oppressed majority of Germany. She's a loner, Liz said, which in terrorist terms means she always works with a small group. She never sends anyone on a mission she wouldn't undertake. They never claim credit.
Well, that's a match with today's attack, Herbert said.
As of 4 months ago, when this file was updated, FOIA had 1,300 members with an annual growth rate of nearly 20%. Of those members, 20 active, full-time soldiers move with her from camp to camp. Do we know where any of these camps are?
They keep changing, Liz said.
We don't know how they travel, but it looks to me like they pitch tents whenever they get there.
Well, they probably move around in a bus or van, Herbert said.
He sounded dejected.
We don't really have very much here, do we?
I'm afraid not.
Look, Herbert said, I'm going to have a chat with the authorities here. Maybe pay a visit to one of these Chaos Days celebrations.
Watch it, Bob. Neo-Nazis don't hold doors for people in wheelchairs. Remember, you're different.
You bet I am. Meanwhile, give me a buzz on the cellular if you come up with anything else on this lady or her group.
Will do. Thursday, 11:52 a.m., Toulouse, France. The wood-paneled room was large and dark. The only light came from a single lamp which stood beside the massive mahogany desk. The shelves behind the desk were barely visible in the shadows. On them were miniature guillotines. Some were working models made of wood and iron. Others were made of glass or metal. Guillotines had been used for official executions in France until 1939. Across from the desk, lost in the ghostly dark, was an 8-foot-tall guillotine which had been used during the French Revolution. This device was unrestored. The uprights were slightly rotted, and the trestle was worn smooth from all the bodies that Madame la Guillotine had embraced. Drawn nearly to the crossbeam on the top, the blade was rusty from rain and blood. It all looked exactly as it did in 1790. At the height of the Reign of Terror, the executioner and his aides were able to decapitate nearly one victim every minute.
What did you think of that, Herr Hitler?
Dominique wondered. The gas chambers at Treblinka were designed to kill 200 people in 15 minutes. Was the master killer impressed, or did he scoff at the work of relative amateurs? The guillotine was Dominique's prize. Behind it, on the wall, were period newspapers and etchings in ornate frames, as well as original documents signed by Georges-Jacques Danton and other leaders of the French Revolution. But nothing stirred him like the guillotine. The telephone beeped. Dominique leaned forward in the fat leather chair. He was a lanky man with a large nose, high forehead, and strong chin. His hair was short and ink black, a dramatic contrast to the white turtleneck and trousers he was wearing. He hit the speaker button.
Yes,
he said quietly.
Good morning, Monsieur Dominique. It's Jean-Michel.
Dominique glanced at his watch.
It's early.
The meeting was brief, Monsieur Dominique.
Tell me about it.
Dominique listened to it all without comment. When Jean-Michel was finished, he asked,
How is your eye?
I think it will be all right.
Good. You know, you shouldn't have gone without Henri and Yves. That is why I sent them.
I know, Monsieur, and I'm sorry. I didn't want to intimidate Herr Richter.
And you didn't, Dominique said.
His voice was tranquil, but his dark eyes were heavy with rage.
Be sure to take them with you tonight.
Now, put Henri on the line. After he gave Henri his instructions, Dominique punched off the speaker button and sat back. Richter was as yet too weak to be a real force in Germany, but he would have to be put in his place before he became one. It would be a delicate thing, making sure that Richter was disciplined without driving him away. But as Danton had said in a speech to the Legislative Committee of General Defense in 1792, boldness and again boldness and always boldness. The boldness of the guillotine, the boldness of conviction. Then as now, that was what people required to win a revolution. And he would win this. Then he would settle an old debt, not with Richter, but with another German, one who had betrayed him on that long-ago night. The man who had put everything in motion. He would destroy Richard Hausen. Thursday, 11:55 a.m., Wunstorf, Germany. It was the bathroom fire alarm which stopped Jody from screaming. The high whine pierced her panic and she breathed in, calmed herself, then exhaled.
They're trying to blow the trailer up, she told herself.
Quickly, she went to the window and pushed her hand through the metal bars. She threw the latch with her fingertips, put her palms to the frosted glass, and pushed up. She pressed her face to the bars and watched the twisted length of cloth as it burned. It wasn't stuffed into the gas tank. It was just lying there, air flowing around it. She pushed her arm out the window, tried to reach the wick. She fell over a foot short.
God, no!
She threw herself back from the bars and looked around.
The sink.
She thought of dousing the fire, but there was nothing in the bathroom to use as a bucket.
Think!
She screamed. She saw the shower, but there were no towels. She tried to pull the towel bar off the back of the stall and failed. Quickly pulling off her blouse, Jody plunged it into the toilet. She slapped it as hard as she could against the side of the trailer, letting the water trickle down the wall. Then she pulled in the blouse, wet it again, and slammed it even harder against the trailer. The water ran down in a solid sheet, dousing the last of the flame and sending up a thin wall of smoke. It was the sweetest smell Jody had ever tasted.
Screw you!
Jody shouted at the image of the woman in her mind.
I don't like killing women, she said. Well, you didn't, bitch. You didn't get me.
Jody pulled in her arm and put on the wet shirt. She looked at the door. There was time now to work the towel bar from the shower stall. Then she went to the bathroom door and put her shoulder to it.
She opened it just enough to get the bar through, then used it as a lever to open a crack large enough to slip through. She stepped over the upended table, ran to the door, and opened it. A shock sizzled down her back. What if they're expecting to hear the explosion? And when they don't, will they come back? Exhausted, Jody ran to the trailer cab. She pushed in the cigarette lighter. While she waited for it to heat up, she tore strips of cloth from the inside lid of one of the trunks in the trailer itself. When the lighter was ready, she lit one of the pieces and walked toward the gas tank. She laid a strip half in and half out of the tank and used the burning strip to ignite the one in the tank, then dropped it and ran into the woods. She heard the muffled timpani boom of the blast, followed by the louder rending of metal and deafening explosion of tires. A heartbeat later, she was hit by the concussive heat wave which rolled from the blast. But she forgot about the heat as hot shards of metal rained down, along with particles of glass. She swung toward a tree and hugged it, kneeling, thinking that the branches might offer some protection against the larger chunks of the trailer. She remained there, shaking, long after the downpour had stopped. Letting go, Jody walked for a while. She was exhausted and lost and decided to rest. Though the soft green grass looked inviting, she pulled herself up into a tree. Cradling herself in two closely spaced branches, she put her head on one of the branches and shut her eyes. Senator Barbara Fox and her two aides arrived at Andrews Air Force Base in the senator's Mercedes. They were early for their 8:30 meeting, as the guard politely informed them before admitting the car.
"On the contrary," the white-haired senator said through the window as they drove past, "we're about $25 million too late."
The trio drove toward a nondescript two-story building located near the Naval Reserve flight line. The building was the headquarters of the Op Center, the seat of the NCMC, the National Crisis Management Center. The 78 full-time employees who worked here were crack tacticians, logisticians, soldiers, diplomats, intelligence analysts, computer specialists, psychologists, reconnaissance experts, environmentalists, attorneys, and media liaisons. The NCMC shared another 42 support personnel with the Department of Defense and the CIA and commanded the Stryker Tactical Strike Team. As her budget-conscious peers were quick to remind her, Senator Fox had been one of the authors of the NCMC Charter, and there was a time when she supported its efforts. Originally, Op Center had been designed to interface with and serve as backup for the Central Intelligence Agency, National Security Agency, White House, State Department, Department of Defense, Defense Intelligence Agency, National Reconnaissance Office, and the Intelligence and Threat Analysis Center. But after handling a hostage situation in Philadelphia, which the Waco-shy FBI dropped in their lap, and uncovering and defusing a sabotage attempt against the space shuttle, Op Center had earned parity with those agencies, and then some. What had been chartered as an information clearinghouse with SWAT capabilities now had the singular capacity to monitor, initiate, and/or manage operations worldwide. And with those singular capacities came a new budget of $61 million. It was a budget the 52-year-old four-term senator from California was not about to accommodate, not with an election coming up. Paul Hood was a longtime friend, but he and his uppity second-in-command, Mike Rogers, were going to have to scale their operations back. Paul Hood's party left the restaurant at 1:20. They dropped Bob Herbert at the hotel so he could continue making calls about the attack on the movie set. Then the group went on to Martin Lang's Hauptschlüssel facility, which was located a scenic 30-minute drive northwest from Hamburg in Glückstadt. Like Hamburg, the town was situated on the Elbe. Unlike Hamburg, it was quaint and old world, the last place Hood would have expected to find a modern microchip factory. Not that the building looked like a factory. It resembled an inverted pyramid covered from top to bottom with dark mirrors. "A stealth gumdrop," Matt Stoll quipped as they approached. Inside the three-story structure was a bright and uncluttered working environment. After showing his guests around the smallish first floor, Lang took them to the more spacious second level. No sooner had they arrived than Hausen's cellular phone beeped.
It may be news about the attack, Hausen said, walking toward a corner. After Hausen left, Lang showed the Americans how the chips were mass-produced by quiet, automated machines. Stoll set his backpack on a table and chatted with one of the technicians, an English-speaking woman who was using a microscope to spot-check finished chips. After the second-floor tour was finished, the group went to the elevator to wait for Hausen. He was still hunched over his telephone. Meanwhile, Stoll peeked into his backpack. He smiled at Hood, who winked back.
Alas, said Lang, I won't be able to take you to the third-floor laboratories where research and development is being conducted. It's nothing personal, I assure you, he said, looking at Stoll. But I fear our stockholders would revolt. You see, we're working on a new technology which will revolutionize the industry.
I see, said Stoll. And this new technology, it wouldn't happen to have anything to do with quantum bits and the superposition principle of quantum mechanics, would it?
Lang paled. He seemed to want to speak, but couldn't. Stoll beamed.
Remember that rotten bread slice thrower router I was telling you about?
Lang nodded, still speechless. Stoll patted the backpack.
Well, Herr Lang, I just gave you a little taste of what it can do.
After his early morning visit with Billy Squires, Rogers used his car phone to call Daryl McCaskey, OpCenter's FBI liaison.
Morning, Daryl.
Morning, General.
Listen, I've got something I need you to check on. Group named WOA, Whites Only Association. Ever hear of them?
Yeah, I've heard of them. Don't tell me you got wind of the Baltic Avenue. That was supposed to be a deep secret.
No, Rogers said. I don't know about it.
A Baltic Avenue was the FBI's current code for an action being taken against a domestic adversary.
Is WOA the subject of the Baltic Avenue?
No, McCaskey replied. Not directly, anyway. Rogers knew better than to ask McCaskey more on this particular mission, so he framed a broader question.
Tell me what you know about WOA.
They're big time. They have a couple of paramilitary training camps. They publish a slick magazine, and they sponsor a successful rock band called Odd, All White Electric Dudes.
They're also online.
I know. Since when do you surf the net?
I don't, but Charlie Squire's kid does. He picked up a hate game about blacks getting lynched.
Shit.
That's how I felt.
In fact, General Rogers thought, the comic books he had bought for Billy seemed downright innocent by comparison. McCaskey said, I was just talking to a German friend in the Office for the Protection of the Constitution in Dusseldorf. They're all worried about chaos days, when all the neo-Nazis over there gather. The OPC is worried because, in addition to chaos days, they've got this new phenomenon called the Thule Network. It's a collection of about 100 mailboxes and bulletin boards which allow neo-Nazi groups and cells to communicate and form alliances. There's no way of tracking the correspondence to its source, so the authorities are helpless to stop it.
I take it this Thule network has made inroads to America.
Not per se. We've got our own homegrown demons. The problem is, like in Germany, the bad guys usually obey the law. Plus, they're fully protected by the First Amendment.
They'll slip up somewhere, Rogers said confidently. And when they do, I want to be there to nail them.
So far, they haven't. And the FBI has been watching all the neo-Nazi websites. We've also got reciprocal agreements with Germany, England, Canada, and Israel to trade any information they pick up online. You know better than anyone that we've fought a whole lot of wars to give free speech to all Americans, including WOA.
We also fought a war to prove that Hitler was wrong.
Speaking of war, McCaskey said, I got a call from Bob Herbert before I left home. Coincidentally, he needs information on a German terrorist group named Feuer. Did you hear about the attack this morning? Rogers said that he hadn't watched the news, and McCaskey briefed him. Liz Gordon has more info on Feuer. I'm going to meet with her and get the essentials right over to Bob, the CIA, and Interpol. They're looking for the perpetrators as well as the missing girl.
Okay, Rogers said. When you're done with that, bring the data and let's you and me and Liz have a talk. I don't think my meeting with Senator Fox will last very long.
Ouch. I've got to meet you after you see her?
I'll be okay. We need more human intelligence out there. I think I can make her see that.
General, I hope you're right. I don't think the lady has had a reasonable day since her daughter was murdered. I wish you luck.
2 minutes later, Rogers was off the expressway and headed toward the gate at Andrews Air Force Base. He phoned Hood on his cellular phone for the short morning check-in. He briefed him on what had happened with Billy and told him that he was putting Darryl on the case to find out who was behind the game. Hood agreed completely. Rogers parked and walked briskly toward the front door. The meeting with Senator Fox was scheduled for 8:30. It was already 8:25. The senator was usually early. She was also usually pissed if whoever she came to see wasn't early.
That will probably be strike one against me, Rogers thought as he rode the elevator down to Op Center's area. Strike two if she's in an unusually bad mood.
When the general exited in the lower level, the sympathetic look on the face of the lower level sentry confirmed that the count was 0-2. He stopped short as he passed Economics Officer Martha McCall's office. The door was open and Senator Fox was sitting inside. He looked at his watch. It was 8:32.
Sorry, he said.
Come in, General Rogers,
the senator said. Her voice was tight, clipped. Rogers sat on the edge of Martha's desk. Senator Fox placed a briefcase in her lap and popped the latches.
You ask for an increase of 18% at a time when government agencies are making across-the-board cuts.
She handed Rogers his own 300-page document.
This is the budget I will present to the Finance Committee. It contains my blue pencil reductions totaling 32%.
Rogers' eyes snapped from the budget to the senator.
Reductions? You've got nerve, Senator.
So do you, General.
These cuts are a death sentence. We have a top-flight organization, and we still lost a man in Korea and Charlie Squires in Russia. If you cut us back, I won't be able to give my people the support they need.
For what? More adventures overseas?
No, he said. Our government's entire intelligence focus has been on ELINT, electronic intelligence, spy satellites, eavesdropping, photo reconnaissance, computers. These are tools, but they aren't enough. 30-40 years ago, we had a human presence around the world. Humint, human intelligence. People who infiltrated foreign governments. The best camera in the world can't pull blueprints from a drawer. Only a human operator can break into a computer which isn't online. A spy satellite can't look into a terrorist's eyes and tell you if he or she is really committed or if he can be turned. We need to rebuild those assets.
A pretty speech, said the senator, but you do not have my support. We do not need this humint to protect American interests. Stryker stopped a Korean lunatic from bombing Tokyo. They saved the administration of a Russian president who has not yet proven that he is our ally. Why should American taxpayers underwrite an international police force?
Because they're the only ones who can. We're not asking for toys or luxuries here, Senator. I'm asking for security for American citizens.
In a perfect world, we would be able to safeguard every building, every airplane, every life.
The senator closed the briefcase.
But it is not a perfect world, and the budget will be cut, as I've indicated. There will be no debate and no hearing.
Fine. When Paul gets back, you can start by cutting my salary.
Please, General, we can do very nicely without the grandstanding.
I'm not trying to be dramatic.
He stood and tugged the hem of his jacket.
I just don't believe in doing anything half-assed. You're an isolationist, Senator. You have been since the tragedy in France.
This has nothing to do with that.
Of course it does. And I understand how you feel. The French did not find your daughter's killer, didn't seem to care very much, so why help them? But you've let that get in the way of the larger picture, of our national interests.
Do you really believe that General Michael Rogers and Op Center are the tent poles which hold the infrastructure up?
We do our part. We need to do more.
And I say we already do too much, Senator Fox shot back. I will not support Op Center as a base for international troubleshooters. A think tank, yes. An intelligence resource, yes. A domestic crisis management center, yes. A team of international Dudley Do-Rights, no. And for what I've just outlined, you will need only the budget I've given you.
The senator nodded to Rogers, offered her hand to Martha, then started to go.
Senator,
Rogers called after her. The senator stopped. She turned, and Rogers took a few steps toward her.
I assume you've heard about the terrorist group that attacked the movie set in Germany?
No.
It happened about 4 hours ago. Several people were killed. Bob Herbert is over there on business and has asked for our assistance.
And do you think that we should help German authorities investigate?
What vital American interests are at stake? Is it cost-effective? Which taxpayers will care?
Rogers weighed his words carefully. He had laid the snare, and Fox strode right in. This was going to hit the senator hard. Only two taxpayers will care. The parents of a 20-year-old American girl who may have been kidnapped by the terrorists. The woman's strong blue-gray eyes melted. The senator trembled slightly. It was a moment before she could speak.
You don't take prisoners, do you, General?
When the enemy surrenders, I do, Senator. She continued to look at him. All the sadness of the world seemed to be there in those eyes, and Rogers felt like hell for reminding her of her own young daughter.
What do you expect me to say?
Of course.
Help them save the girl. She's an American.
Thank you. And I'm very sorry. Sometimes American interests are hidden in the things we do. The senator walked quickly from the office, her aides trailing close behind. Hood and Martin Lang had both been startled when Hausen returned and announced shakily that he had to leave.
I'll see you later, in my office, he said as he shook Hood's hand.
I've never seen him like that,
Lang said.
Maybe there's been a death, Hood suggested.
Perhaps, but he would have told us. He would have postponed our meeting.
Lang shook his head slowly.
It's very strange.
Hood was concerned without knowing why. Though he barely knew Hausen, he had the impression that the deputy foreign minister was a man of unusual strength and compassion. Hausen had shouted down neo-Nazis at the first chaos days years before. For Hausen to run from anything seemed out of character. But the men still had work to do, and Lang led them to his office. Stoll held up the backpack.
Where can I set this up?
On the desk is fine, Lang said.
Lang watched intently as Stoll unpacked the bag. The first object he removed was a silver box roughly the size of a shoebox. It had an iris-like shutter in front and an eyepiece in the back.
Solid-state laser with viewfinder, he said helpfully.
The second object resembled a compact fax machine.
Imaging system with optical and electrical probes, he said.
Then he removed a third object, which was a white plastic box with cables. It was slightly smaller than the first.
Power pack, Stoll said. Never know when you're going to have to rev up in the wilderness.
Rev up what? Lang asked.
In a peanut shell, Stoll said, what we call our T-bird. It directs a fast laser pulse at a solid-state device generating laser pulses. These pulses last, about 100 femtoseconds, which is a tenth of a trillionth of a second.
He pressed a square red button on the back of the power pack.
What you get are terahertz oscillations that wriggle around between the infrared and radio wave area of the spectrum. What that gives you is the ability to tell what's inside or behind something thin. Paper, wood, plastic, almost anything. All you have to do is interpret the change in the waveforms to tell what's on the other side. And, coupled with this baby, he patted the imaging device, you actually get to see what's inside.
Like an X-ray,
Lang said.
Only without the X's, said Stoll. And it's much more portable.
Stoll walked over to Lang and held out his hand.
Could I borrow your wallet?
Stoll placed the wallet on the opposite side of the desk. Then he went over and pressed a button. The silver box hummed for a moment, and then the fax-like device began to scroll out a piece of paper.
Pretty quiet, Stoll said. I was able to do this in your lab without the technician I was talking to hearing it.
Stoll handed the paper to Lang.
Is that your wife and kids?
Lang looked down at the slightly fuzzy black-and-white image of his family.
Remarkable.
Imagine what you'd get if you ran the picture through a computer, cleaned up the rough edges and brought out the details.
Lang asked, what's the effective range?
The moon? At least that's as far as we've tested it. Looked inside the Apollo 11 lander. Armstrong and Aldrin were pretty tidy guys. Theoretically, it should work as far as the laser can travel.
My God, Lang said. This is beautiful.
The T-Bird is going to be a vital component of the regional op center, said Hood. But we need to make it more compact so operatives can carry it in the field.
That's where your smaller chips come in, said Stoll. We want it so that a guy can stand outside an embassy and read the mail inside.
It amounts to a technology swap, Hood continued.
You get what we have in that box. We get your chip. Lang said,
it's amazing. Is there anything the T-Bird cannot see through?
Metal's the big thing, said Stoll, but we're working on the problem.
Amazing, Lang repeated, as he continued to stare at the photograph.
Bob Herbert spent a frustrating hour plus on the phone. Sitting in his wheelchair and using his private line, Herbert spent part of the time talking with his assistant at Op Center, Alberto Grimotes. Alberto was fresh out of Johns Hopkins, a clever Ph.D. psychologist. Question one, Herbert said, was trying to figure out which of their intelligence allies they could tap for up-to-the-minute information about German terrorists. Herbert held on while Alberto checked their HUMINT, human intelligence, database. Of course, assuming that other governments did have German HUMINT, there was no guarantee that they would even be willing to share their information. Since the well-publicized U.S. intelligence security leaks in the 1980s, other nations were reluctant to tell too much of what they knew. They didn't want their own resources compromised.
You want a laugh? Alberto asked.
I could use one, Herbert said.
Looking over this list, the only help I see us getting is from Bernard.
If the situation weren't so serious, Herbert would indeed have laughed.
Help from them? He said. It'll never happen, never.
It might, Alberto said.
Let me just read this report from Darrell.
Bernard was Colonel Bernard Benjamin Ballon of France's Groupe d'Intervention de la Gendarmerie Nationale. Historically, that law enforcement organization was deaf and blind when it came to hate crimes, especially those committed against Jews and immigrants. The Gendarmerie also had an understanding with the Germans. If French agents stayed out of Germany, Germany wouldn't reveal the names of the thousands upon thousands of collaborators who had helped the Nazis during the war. Some of those men and women were now business and political leaders. In his 40s, Ballon himself was one of the most rabid, hit-justice-in-the-balls kind of guys Herbert had ever met. And he was dragging the Gendarmerie, bucking and screaming, out of the muck of its own apathy. Still, Ballon had a government to answer to, and that government was not fond of the United States. They were in the throes of intense, renewed nationalism, to the extent that they were tossing English words from their vocabulary, American foods off their menus, and Hollywood films off their movie screens. The notion that they would even help the U.S. was positively absurd. Alberto said, Bernard's got a problem at home and has been looking into possible connections between hostile elements in France and Germany. He contacted the Interpol last month, and they contacted Darrell. Darrell helped Bernard get some information he needed. Darrell was not only OpCenter's liaison with the FBI, but he interfaced with Interpol and other international anti-crime organizations as well.
What kind of information did Bernard want?
Herbert asked.
That data's not in the file. It's eyes only. I'll have to go to Darrell for it. Do, and call me as soon as you have something. Also, brief General Rogers. Tell him I'm going to check out a few chaos theories, which brings me to question number two. Have you got anything there on where the hub of these Chaos Days activities usually is?
Herbert could hear the tap of the computer keys.
Yes, Alberto said. For the past 2 years, many conventioneers have kicked off events with a 6 p.m. toast at the Beer Hall in Hanover.
Why am I not surprised? Herbert said. Munich's infamous Beer Hall Putsch of 1923 was when Hitler had made his first failed attempt at seizing power in Germany. Only where Hitler failed, these men obviously intended to succeed. The second half of Herbert's time on the telephone was spent tracking down an automobile with hand-operated gas and brake pedals. Deciding to dress down, he took off his white shirt and tie and pulled on the My Name is Herbert, Bob Herbert shirt his sister had given him. Then he donned his blazer and headed downstairs. With the help of the doorman, he put his wheelchair, fully open, in a special well in the seatless back. Then, with a map open on the passenger seat, his detachable wheelchair phone beside it, and Matt Stoll's electronic translator beside that, Herbert took his new Mercedes on the road. It was ironic, he thought, sad and ironic, that a man with restricted mobility represented the sum total of American HUMINT in Germany. But he was thrilled to be back in action. The drive from the hotel took under 2 hours. It was a straight ride down the north-south running Autobahn. Herbert clipped along at nearly 90 miles an hour. The quaint section of the city of Hanover was where most of the cafes and restaurants were located. The charm hid the vipers. He got there simply by noticing and following three skinheads on motorcycles. There was no mistaking the beer hall. The tavern had a white brick facade and a simple sign with its name. The block letters were in black, and the background was red.
Of course they are, Herbert muttered as he drove by.
Those were the colors of Nazi Germany. Though displaying swastikas was illegal in Germany, these people had invoked the likeness without breaking the law. But if the beer hall wasn't a surprise, the people gathered in front of it were. Nearly 300, mostly young men, were standing or sitting on the sidewalk, curb, or street. Ahead, four police officers were directing traffic. Herbert had expected an army of skinheads. There was a smattering of punks, but most of the men and the few women he saw were dressed in casual designer clothes, looking very much like young stockbrokers or attorneys. The scene was frightening in its ordinariness. Part of him screamed inside, "They have no right, the young bastards!" But another part of him knew that they had every right. Ironically, the defeat of Hitler had given them the right to say or do a great deal, as long as there was no racial or religious incitement or public denial of the Holocaust. As Herbert rounded the corner, he saw that the side streets were closed for parking. Turning down one of the streets, he found a place to park. Then he pressed a button beside the radio. The left back door opened, and the well in which the wheelchair sat slid to that side. The entire bucket emerged from the car and deposited the wheelchair on the ground. Sliding into the chair, he pressed a button in the car door to retract the bucket. When it was back inside, he shut the car door and began rolling down the street toward the beer hall. Dominique could feel victory. He felt it more strongly now that his New York attorney had phoned to say that the NYPD and the FBI had taken the bait. They had arrested the Pure Nation team, which Dominique had underwritten for these many, many months. His people would bear their arrest and trial like true Nazis, proudly and unafraid. At the same time, they would send the FBI to arms caches and literature, and the FBI would crow about its victories.
Its victories. Dominique grinned. Their scavenger hunt.
A hunt which would eat up time and personnel and lead the crack law officers in the wrong direction. Dominique stood looking through the one-way mirror in a conference room which adjoined his office, a room which looked down into his underground factory. Workers were assembling video game cartridges and pressing CD-ROM games. Most of the games he manufactured at Demain were mainstream entertainment. The other games, however, were much, much closer to Dominique's heart. Indeed, they were one of the keys to the future of the world. My world, he thought. His favorites were the newest ones. Concentration Camp and Hanging with the Crowd would help to spread the message of intolerance. But they were just the beginning. 4 weeks after the release of these games, Dominique would undertake his most ambitious game project. It would begin with a game sent free to online users. It would be called R.I.O.T.S. Revenge is Only the Start. And it would help to precipitate a crisis the likes of which America had anticipated only in its worst nightmares. And while America was distracted, and Germany wrestled with its own surging neo-Nazis, Dominique and his partners would seize their business empires. In the 1980s, when President Mitterrand needed to generate income for the government, many French businesses had been socialized. During the 1990s, those businesses began to collapse due to the costly burden of catering to the French citizens who were accustomed to being cared for from cradle to grave. The failing companies dragged numerous banks with them, all of which had helped to raise unemployment in France. Dominique would begin to change things by purchasing many of those companies and privatizing them. The unemployed would have jobs, and the employed would have security. He also planned to gain controlling interest in a French bank. He already had acquisition deals pending with several foreign companies. In foreign countries, having control of important business was tantamount to having your foot on the throat of the government. As she cleared a patch of trees and looked ahead, Karin Döring allowed herself a very rare smile. The camp was one of the most beautiful sights she had ever seen. The spot on the Leine River was sweet-smelling woodland, with a river to the east and a high hill to the west directly behind them. A deep gorge protected them to the north, and the trees provided cover from spying eyes in the air. The camp was a series of tents, with the tops covered with foliage so they couldn't be seen from the air. The cars and vehicles which had brought them here were also camouflaged. The nearest town of any size was Garbson, which was nearly 20 miles to the south. The ground search for the terrorists who attacked the film set would start there and move toward Hanover, the seat of Chaos Day's activities. That was well southeast of them. The authorities would not look for them here, in the middle of this Grimm Brothers fairyland. "Let them try to catch us," she thought defiantly. The 40 members of Foyer who had come here were among Karin's most devoted followers. Cheers rose from those nearest the perimeter as her van pulled up. Karin said nothing as she emerged. She walked to the back of the van, pulled open the door, and grabbed a steel helmet. There were hints of rust, but an eagle and swastika on a black shield were vivid and clean. Karin held the helmet in her open hands and stretched it before her as though she were crowning a king.
"Warriors of the cause," she said. "Today we have enjoyed a great victory. These trappings of the Reich are once again in the hands of patriots."
The firemen cried, "Sieg euer Feuer!" in unison, and Karin handed the relics to her followers. She kept an S.A. dagger for herself. Manfred walked from around the cab.
"There's a phone call for you. Felix Richter."
Karin was surprised. She didn't expect to speak with him tonight at the rally in Hanover, much less talk to him before then. What troubled her about Richter was that she had never been convinced of his devotion to Nazism. He seemed to be more interested in making Felix Richter a dictator of anything. It didn't matter what.
"Good afternoon, Felix," she said into the phone. "Karin, have you heard?"
"About what?"
"We've been attacked. Germany has. The movement."
"By whom?"
"The French," said Richter.
"Go on," Karin said.
"This morning I met with Dominique's emissary to Chaos Days. He demanded that I fold my organization into his. When I refused, my club was destroyed, burnt. I was led out at gunpoint by two of Dominique's goons. Karin, these people intend to build a network of organizations to serve them. They imagine that we will be just another voice in their chorus."
"Let them imagine that," she said.
"The Führer allowed other governments to imagine whatever they wished. Then he forced his will on them." "We must control the people, and they're here, Karin, now. I have a plan for making tonight an evening history will remember."
"All right, Felix. I'm listening. What do you propose?"
She listened carefully, her interest high, and her respect for him rising slightly. It would be unexpected, daring, truly historic.
"All right, Felix. I agree that we should do this. Come to my camp before the rally and we'll arrange it. Tonight, the French will learn that they can't fight Feuer with fire."
"I like that," Richter said. "I like that very much. But one of them will learn it before then, Karin."
Hood and Stoll had spent the early afternoon outlining their technical needs and financial parameters to Martin Lang. After the meeting and a half-hour ride back to Hamburg, the three headed a few miles northeast to the modern City Nord region. When they arrived, Richard Hausen's neatly groomed young male assistant, Reiner, showed them right into the deputy foreign minister's office. Hausen was on the phone. While Stoll sat down to have a look at the minister's computer setup, Lang watching over his shoulder, Hood walked over to the large picture window. As far as Hood could tell from looking at him, Hausen was once again his strong, outspoken self. Whatever had been bothering him earlier was either taken care of or somehow had been back-burnered. Hood thought sadly, "If only I could do the same." God, he thought how he wanted to despise her, but he couldn't. Now, as then, he felt that somehow he was the one who had screwed up. "Though you'll never know for sure," he told himself. And that was nearly as bad as what had happened, not knowing why it had happened. He absently ran his hand along the breast pocket of his sports jacket, the pocket with his wallet, the wallet with the tickets with the memories. As he looked out the window at the park, he asked himself,
And what would you have done if it had been her? Asked her, so, how've you been? Are you happy? Oh, and by the way, hon, why didn't you put a bullet in my heart to finish the job? It's quite a view, is it not? Hausen asked. Hood came back to reality hard. It's a magnificent view. Back home, I don't even have a window. Hausen smiled. The work we do is different, Herr Hood. I need to see the people I serve. I need to see young couples pushing baby carriages. I need to see elderly couples walking hand in hand. I need to see children playing. I envy you that. Your job is to destroy corruption and tyranny. My arena is the antithesis of that. I try to nurture growth and cooperation. You must understand, Herr Hood, Hitler lifted us from defeat in a world war, helped to end a depression, took back lands to which many people felt we were entitled, and attacked peoples whom many Germans detested. Why do you think the neo-Nazi movement is so strong today? Because many Germans still believe that he was right. But you fight these people now, Hood said. What made you realize that Hitler was wrong? Hausen spoke in hard, unhappy half-tones. I don't wish to appear rude, Herr Hood, but that is something I have never discussed with anyone, nor would I burden a new friend with it. Why not? Hood asked. New friends bring new perspectives. Not to this, Hausen said emphatically.
Gentlemen, mein Herrs, Stoll said. Come hither, please.
Hood was more curious than ever about Hausen, but he recognized that familiar something's-wrong urgency in Matt Stoll's voice, and he saw Lang with his hand over his mouth as if he'd just witnessed a car crash. Hood gave the stoic Hausen a reassuring pat on the back of the shoulder, then turned and hurried to the computer.
I thank you, General. I thank you very sincerely, but the answer is no.
Sitting in his office, leaning back in his chair, Mike Rogers knew very well that the voice on the other end of the secure telephone was sincere. He also knew that once the owner of that strong voice said something, he seldom retracted it. Brett August had been that way since he was 6. But Rogers was also sincere. Sincere in his desire to land the colonel for Stryker. And Rogers was not a man who gave up on anything. A 10-year veteran of the Air Force's Special Operations Command, August was a childhood friend of Rogers who loved airplanes. After school, each day, the boys would do their homework together. Then they would build model airplanes. When it came time to serve, Rogers went into the Army and August went into the Air Force. Both men ended up in Vietnam. Although Rogers and August had seen one another only intermittently in the post-Vietnam years, each time they talked or got together, it was as if no time had passed. One or the other of them would bring the model airplane, the other would bring the paint and glue, and together they would have the time of their lives.
Brett, Rogers said, look at it this way. Over the past quarter century, you've been out of the country more than you've been in. Nam, the Philippines, Cape Canaveral.
That's funny, General.
Now Italy, and at a nowhere near state-of-the-art NATO base, think of the great times we'll have if you come back home.
General, Brett said, it'd be an honor to command a team like Stryker. But I'd be landlocked at Quantico most of the time, and that'd drive me crazy. At least now I get to travel around Europe and put my 2 cents in on various projects. Rogers drummed his desktop. He had only one more card to play, and he intended to make this one work.
You're also homesick. You told me so the last time you were here.
What if I promise that you won't be landlocked? I've been wanting to send Stryker on maneuvers with other Special Forces teams around the world.
Let's do it. We're also working on a regional op center facility. When that's up and running, we'll move you and Stryker around. You can spend a month in Italy, then in Germany, in Norway.
I'm doing that now.
But for the wrong team, Rogers said. Just come back for a few days. Talk to me. Look over the team. You bring the glue and I'll bring the airplane.
August was quiet. All right, he said after a long time. I'll work out leave with General DeFatte, but I'm only coming back to talk and build the kit. No promises.
No promises, Rogers agreed.
Bob Herbert huffed a little as he wheeled himself away from his car. Herbert didn't have a motor on his wheelchair, and he never would. He liked moving under his own steam, and he loved the endorphin rush he got from turning the millstone weight of the wheels.
The intelligence chief wheeled himself up the street behind the beer hall, turned the corner, and rolled toward the crowd drinking and singing out front. The men nearest him turned to look at him.
Fellows, look who is here. It is Franklin Roosevelt, and he is searching for Yalta.
So much for no one making a comment about my disability, Herbert thought. Another man raised his beer stein.
Herr Roosevelt, you are just in time. The new war has begun.
Yeah, said the first man, though this one will end differently.
Herbert kept wheeling toward them. He glanced to the left. A police officer was in the middle of the street, some 200 yards past them. He was looking the other way, working hard to keep the traffic from stopping.
Did he hear what these cretins were saying?
Herbert wondered. Or was he also working hard to stay the hell out of whatever happened? The neo-Nazis didn't move. Herbert rolled to within inches of their shoes, then stopped. In standoffs in Lebanon and other trouble spots, Herbert had always taken a low-keyed approach.
Excuse me, he said.
One of the men glanced down at him.
No, this street is closed. It's a private party. I've seen other people walking through. Will you excuse me?
You are not walking, so you may not pass.
I don't want problems. I'm just thirsty, and I'd like to get a drink.
Several men laughed. A man with a beer stein shouldered through the wall of men.
You're thirsty?
The man said.
Would you like some of my beer?
Herbert knew what was coming. He slipped his right hand under the armrest. With a look of contempt, the German tipped the stein over and slowly poured the contents into Herbert's lap. When the neo-Nazi was finished and received only scattered applause, Herbert yanked his sawed-off broom handle from under the armrest. With a turn of the wrist, he jabbed the neo-Nazi in the groin. The German cried out, doubled over, and staggered back against his colleagues. The crowd yelled and surged forward, threatening to become a mob. Herbert felt a tug on the back of his wheelchair.
Aufenthalt!
Shouted a raspy voice from behind. Herbert looked back. A skinny police officer had stopped directing traffic and was standing behind him, holding the grips of the chair. He was hooted and threatened, but he said to Herbert in English,
Do you have an automobile?
Herbert told him where he was parked. As Herbert was wheeled away, anger and determination filled him. He was leaving, but he resolved to get these goons. Not here and not now, but somewhere else. And soon. One of the men had separated from the crowd. He went into the beer hall, exited by the back door, crossed through an alley, and emerged on the same street as Herbert and the police officer. The young man followed them. As one of Karin Doring's personal lieutenants, he had been instructed to watch anyone who might be watching them. The man pulled a telephone from his pocket. He described the license tag and the make of Herbert's rented car. A moment later, a white van pulled out of a parking area located three blocks from Bob Herbert. What's the problem? Hood asked as he reached Stoll's side.
Something really sick is going on. I'll show you in a second. I was checking out Herrhausen's cache memory capacities, and I found a file that was put in at 1:12 p.m. today. That's when we were having lunch.
Hausen said, But no one was here, Herr Stoll, except for Reiner.
I know, Stoll said. And, by the way, he's gone now.
Hausen looked at Stoll.
Gone? Split.
Stoll pointed into the reception area.
As soon as I sat down here, he vamoosed. Your computer's been answering the phones ever since. Reiner left you a little love letter, which I'll show you in a minute. First, though, I want you to see this.
The computer screen went from blue to black. White stripes slashed across the screen horizontally. They morphed into strands of barbed wire, then changed again to form the words, Concentration Camp. Finally, the letters turned red and pooled into blood, which filled the screen. Next came a succession of clear, detailed, computer-animated snippets. Crowds of men, women, and children walking through the gate. Prisoners grabbing shovels, being kicked and punched by guards. A large party of men threw down their shovels and ran into the darkness. An SS guard appeared in close-up and spoke to the player. His face was the animated photograph of Hausen. Behind him was a pastoral setting of trees, rivers, and the corner of a red brick citadel.
25 prisoners have escaped into the woods. Your job is to divide your force so that you can find them, at the same time maintaining the productivity of the camp and continuing the processing of the bodies of subhumans.
The letter, Hausen said as they watched the program. What did Reiner's letter say?
Stoll killed the game. The letter came up, and Lang leaned closer. He translated for the Americans.
Herr Savior, I hope you enjoy this game while it is still a game. And it is signed Reiner.
Hood was watching Hausen closely. He looked like he wanted to cry.
4 years. We were together 4 years.
We fought for human rights in the newspapers, on television. Looks like he was there just to spy on you, Hood said. But why wait until now?
Chaos days,
Lang offered. I'd be surprised if that was the case. This is a professional quality game. My guess is that Reiner planted it for someone. Someone who didn't need him here any longer. The other three men were shocked as Hausen put his hands on his face and wailed.
Christ God, he moaned. Dominique. Gérard Dominique.
Who is Dominique?
Lang asked.
The devil.
He shook his head.
Gentlemen, I'm sorry. I can't talk about this now.
Then don't, Hood said, putting a hand on his shoulder. Matt, can you download that game to Op Center?
Stoll nodded.
Good. Herr Hausen, do you recognize that photograph of yourself?
No, I'm sorry. That's okay.
Matt, have you got anything in your arsenal to handle this? I'll have to run it through our photo file back home. I can have my office run the geolog on the scenery and see what it tells us.
The geolog was a detailed satellite relief study of the world. From it, computers could generate an acre-by-acre view of the planet from any angle. If the photograph hadn't been tinkered with, the geolog would tell them where it was taken. The operations support officer phoned his assistant, Eddie Medina, to let him know the images were coming.
Hood squeezed Hausen's shoulder. Let's go for a walk.
Thank you. No, Hausen replied.
I need it, Hood said. This has been a strange day for me, too. Hausen managed a small smile.
All right.
Hood would wear him down. It was more than a coincidence that what had just happened in the office was similar to what had happened this morning on Billy Squires' computer. That game, hanging with the crowd, had been a lynch mob chasing black people. And if this was happening simultaneously on two continents, then Op Center needed to know why. Fast. After his encouraging chat with Brett August, the morning sped by for Mike Rogers. Matt Stoll's assistant, Eddie, briefed him on what was happening in Germany and told him he'd put in a call for assistance to Bernard Ballon of the Gendarmerie Nationale. Ballon was on a mission against terrorists, the new Jacobins, and had not returned the call. Rogers was more concerned about Herbert going to check on chaos activities by himself. Rogers wasn't worried because Herbert was in a wheelchair. He was worried because Herbert could be like a dog with a bone. He didn't like letting go of unsolved cases. And there was only so much Op Center could do to help him. Liz Gordon, the psychologist, arrived shortly after Eddie's call, and Daryl McCaskey knocked and was told to come in. He sat down and opened his power book. Rogers said,
Tell me something healing, Daryl.
Well, the FBI is pretty happy.
The Baltic Avenue?
McCaskey nodded. It went off perfectly. They got the Pure Nation group and their computer. It's got names, addresses, a couple of bank accounts, right-wing subscription lists, weapons caches, and more.
Like what?
Rogers asked. The big catch was their plans to attack a Shaka Zulu Society meeting in Harlem next week. 10 men were going to take hostages and demand a separate state for black Americans.
Liz snorted.
What's wrong? Rogers asked.
I don't believe it. Groups like Pure Nation aren't political activists. They're rabid racists. They don't demand states for minorities. They erase them. Hate, by its very nature, is extreme. It doesn't seek an accommodation with the object of its loathing.
But Liz, said McCaskey, groups can and do change. Leadership changes. Goals change.
She shook her head.
Only the public face changes. It's so right-thinking people give them a little rope so they can hang the object of their hate.
Follow the thread, Rogers urged.
Okay. They set up a shop on Christopher Street, which is populated heavily by gay establishments. They target a black group for hostage-taking. The FBI busts them up, there's a public trial, and gays and blacks are openly outraged. There's a backlash. The aftermath of this aborted Pure Nation attack, if there were in fact really going to be one, will be a rise in black militancy, gay militancy, Jewish militancy, and when this widespread polarization threatens the infrastructure, threatens the community, the average white American will get scared. And, ironically, the government won't be able to help, because they can't crack down on minorities. They come down on blacks, the blacks cry foul. They come down on gays, Jews, the same thing. Come down on all of them, and you've got a goddamn war on your hands. Rogers said, so the average American, normally a good and fair person, gets drawn toward the radicals. Pure Nation and Woe and the rest of them start to look like society's salvation. Exactly, said Liz. McCaskey made a face. This is surreal. Think of the damage Pure Nation could do as decoys, Liz said. Rogers felt a chill. They could, in fact, lead the proud, victorious FBI every which way but right. With the media following their every step, the FBI could never even admit that they'd been duped. The phone rang, and Rogers picked up. From the other end of the phone, Herbert said calmly, I'm on a road in the middle of the boonies in Germany, and I need something.
What?
Either a lot of help fast, or a real short prayer. Hamburg has a distinctive, very seductive radiance in the late afternoon, but Hood's appreciation of his surroundings was brief. No sooner had they left the building and begun walking toward the park than Hausen began talking. What has made this day so strange for you? Hood didn't really want to talk about himself, but he hoped that by doing so he could loosen Hausen's tongue. While Matt, Bob, and I were waiting for you in the hotel lobby, I thought I saw a woman I once knew. She got into a cab before I could reach her. If it wasn't Nancy, it was her daughter.
Has she one?
Hood shrugged. I was in love with this girl. Her name was Nancy Jo Bosworth. We'd met in a computer class at USC in our last year of graduate school. She was this delicate and vivacious angel with hair that was like layers of golden wings. He grinned, flushed. It's corny, I know, but I don't know how else to describe it. Her eyes were life itself. I called her my little golden lady, and she called me her big silver knight. Man, was I smitten. The German smiled for the first time. Hood was glad he was getting through. This was killing him. We got engaged after we got out of school. I landed a position as an assistant to the mayor of Los Angeles, and Nancy went to work for a video game company designing software. And then one night, April 21st, 1979, to be exact, I was waiting for her outside a movie theater, and she failed to show. I called her apartment. No one was there. So I rushed over. I found a note. It said that she had to go away. She wouldn't be coming back. And I shouldn't look for her. She took some clothes, but everything else was still there.
No one else had any idea where she was?
Hausen asked. No one. Not even the FBI, which came and asked me about her the next morning without telling me what she had done.
Gott,
Hausen said. And you never heard from her after that? Hood shook his head slowly. I never heard of her, either. I have to thank her for one thing, though. I lost myself in work. And eventually I ran for and won the office of mayor. Hausen looked at Hood's wedding band.
You also married?
Yes, I married. I have a wonderful family, a good life. But I still think of Nancy now and then. And it's probably a good thing it wasn't her at the hotel.
You don't know that it wasn't her.
But even if it was, your Nancy belonged to another time, a different Paul Hood. If you saw her again, you would be able to deal with it, I think. Perhaps, said Hood. And he asked himself, who do you think you're fooling? He knew damn well that if he saw Nancy face to face, he'd fall for her all over again. So, that's my story. Now it's your turn. Did that phone call back in your office have anything to do with a lost love or mysterious disappearances? Hausen walked in dignified silence for a short while, then said solemnly,
mysterious disappearances, yes. Love,
No, not at all. I'm probably mad to be telling you this. I've never told anyone, not even my sister, and not my friends. Yet someone has to know, now that he has returned. They have to know in the event that anything happens to me. Housen looked at Hood. The agony that came into his eyes was like nothing Hood had ever seen. 25 years ago, I was a political science student at the Sorbonne in Paris. My best friend was a fellow named Gérard Dupré. Gérard's father was a wealthy industrialist, and Gérard was a radical. Dupré hated Americans and Asians, and he especially hated Jews, blacks, and Catholics. Dear God, he was consumed by hate. Housen swallowed and went on. We were dining at a café one night on the left bank, a short walk from the university. After paying the bill, we went for a walk along the Seine. It was dark, and we encountered a pair of American students who had just arrived in Paris. They had gone to take some pictures by a remote section of riverbank, under a bridge. They couldn't find their way back to the dormitory, so I started to give them directions. But Gérard interrupted and said that he thought Americans knew everything, so how could these two not know where they were going? The girls thought he was joking. One of them put her hand on Gerard's arm to say something, but Gérard pushed her away. She stumbled back into the river. Her friend dropped her camera and ran to help, but Gérard grabbed her. He held her with the inside of his elbow around her neck. I ran to help the girl in the river. Gérard was angry that I tried to help, and while he yelled at me, he held the girl very hard. Housen stopped. The anguish in his eyes had spread. His mouth was slack. His hands were trembling. Gérard dropped the girl to the ground. Then he ran to the river, jumped in, and pushed the other girl down. I tried to stop him, but I went under. By the time I got up, it was too late. The girl was bobbing in the river. Gérard pulled himself from the water and dragged the other girl in. Then he told me to come away with him. I was in a daze. I fumbled in the dark, picking my things up, and went with him. We went to his father's estate in the south of France and remained there for several weeks. I found no peace. So I returned to Germany, went to the French embassy and told them what had happened. I told them everything. They said they would question Gérard, and I told them where they could find me. I was willing to go to jail just to appease my guilt. And what happened? The French police, Housen said bitterly, are different from other police forces. Did they even question Gérard? I don't know. But even if they did, think of it. The word of a French billionaire's son against that of a poor German boy. What about the parents of the girls? I can't believe they let it go at that. What could they do? They came to France and they demanded justice, but the French turned their backs on the families, and that was that. Gérard wrote to me and said he would return someday to teach me a lesson about cowardice and betrayal. Other than that, you didn't hear from him? Not until today, when he phoned me. A killer is at large because of my silence. He now calls himself Gérard Dominique, and he has threatened me and my 13-year-old daughter. I didn't realize you had children, Hood said. Where is she? She lives with her mother in Berlin. I'll have her watched, but Gérard is elusive as well as powerful. Did you hear anything about him over the years? No, he vanished, just like your Nancy. There were rumors that he had gone into business with his father, but when the old man died, Gérard closed down the Airbus factory. He was rumored to have become the power behind many executive boards without being on any, but I don't know that for a fact. Hood had other questions for the man, but his attention was snatched away by a soft voice that called him from behind. Paul. Hood turned, and the glow of Hamburg seemed to dim, and the years themselves disappeared as the tall, slender, graceful angel walked toward him, as he found himself once again standing in front of a movie theater, waiting for Nancy, waiting for the girl who had finally arrived.
Bob Herbert had not phoned Mike Rogers when he first saw the white van in his rearview mirror. When he turned off onto a side street, and the van turned as well, he gave it a second look. In the front and back of the van were faces wearing ski masks. As the city of Hanover darkened with the fast-falling night, Herbert phoned Op Center.
"What's wrong?" Rogers asked.
"I had a run-in with some neo-Nazis back at a beer house. Now they're after my ass."
The van rammed his fender. As the car bolted forward, the shoulder strap of the seatbelt tore into his chest. Herbert swerved to avoid a car in front of him.
"Shit!"
he yelled. He drove around the car and sped up.
"Listen, General, these guys are ramming me. Tell the Landespolizei I'm in a white Mercedes. They're trying to kill me."
The van smashed into him again on the left rear side. The right side of the car hopped onto the sidewalk, where Herbert nearly clipped a man. He managed to swerve back onto the road. He stopped. Herbert looked in his side mirror to make sure he could pull away again. Pedestrians were running, and cars were now racing past. The van pulled up beside him on the left. The figure in the passenger seat faced him, stuck a submachine gun from the open window, and trained it on the car. He fired. Dressed in a short black skirt and jacket, with a white blouse and pearls, Nancy looked as if she were walking from a mirage. Hazy, slow, rippling. Or maybe she looked that way because of the tears in Hood's eyes. Housen's voice seemed muffled and soft.
"Are you all right?"
"I'm not sure," Hood replied.
"Hello,"
she said quietly. The voice had matured. Along with the face, there were lines to the sides of the blue eyes, on her once smooth forehead and along the upper lip. Hood found them almost unbearably sexy. She also looked fitter than she had ever been. He fought a nearly losing battle to put his arms around her, to crush her to him from cheek to thighs. He settled for, "Hello, Nancy." Nancy's eyes shifted to Hood's right. She offered Hausen her hand.
"Nancy Joe Bosworth," she said.
"Richard Hausen," he replied.
"I know. I recognized you."
Hood said to Hausen, "I wonder if you would give me just a minute."
"Certainly. I'll see you back in my office."
Hood nodded. "What you were saying a moment ago, we'll talk more. I can help with that."
"Thank you," the German said.
He walked away.
"I'm sorry," she said.
"It's all right." Nancy touched his face.
"There was a reason I left the way I did."
"How did you find me?"
"I had to return papers to the hotel. The doorman told me a Paul had been looking for me and that he was with Deputy Foreign Minister Hausen. I called Hausen's office and came right over."
"Why?" Hood asked.
"God, Paul, to see you. To apologize, to explain, but mostly to see you. I missed you terribly. I followed your career in Los Angeles as best I could. I was very proud of what you'd done. I left because I was in terrible trouble. If I'd stayed, or if I told you where I'd gone."
She came closer and stroked his cheek again.
"Paul, I stole the blueprints for a new chip my company was going to make and sold them to an overseas firm. In exchange for the blueprints, I got a ton of money. We would have been married, we would have been rich, and you would have been a deadly great politician."
"Is that what you think I wanted?" Hood asked. "To be successful on someone else's efforts?" Nancy shook her head.
"You never would have known. I wanted you to be able to run for office without worrying about money."
"I can't believe you did that."
"I know. That's why I didn't tell you. I didn't want your scorn."
She lowered her hand, turned away.
"Anyway, I did get found out somehow. A friend. You remember Jessica?"
Hood nodded.
"Jess was working late," Nancy said. "And as I was getting ready to meet you at the movies, she phoned to tell me two FBI agents had been there. She said the men were on their way to question me. I only had time to gather up my passport, some clothes, write you that short note and get the hell out of the country. I assumed you would be questioned or watched or your phone would be tapped.
If I had called or written, the FBI would have found me.
That's true. Only I never would have abandoned you. What did you do after you left?
Hood asked, wanting to talk instead of think. I moved to Paris, and I tried to get a job designing computer software. There wasn't much of a market yet, so after burning through the blood money I'd been paid, I moved to Toulouse and began working for the company.
The company?
The one I sold the secrets to. I don't want to tell you the name because I don't want you doing anything out of your famous white knight spite. Because you know you would.
Nancy was right. He'd have found a dozen different ways for the U.S. government to lean on them.
Nancy said, the not-so-funny thing was, I always suspected that the guy I sold those plans to was the one who turned me in, to force me to come over and work for him.
She smiled unhappily.
To top it all off, I failed at love repeatedly because I compared everyone to you.
Gee, I can't tell you how much better that makes me feel.
Don't be like that.
And why did you decide to see me now?
I couldn't help myself.
Hood looked into those eyes with which he had spent so many days and nights. The pull was both extraordinary and awful, a dream and a nightmare. He stepped back. An almost electric connection broke.
I can't do this, he said. I can't stay here with you.
Not even for an hour? For coffee? To catch up?
No, Hood said firmly. This is my closure. You left without an explanation, and I met someone else. Someone who trusted me with her life and heart. I won't do anything to cheapen that.
I didn't ask you to. I understand. I'm sorry. For everything. Sorrier than I can say. And I'm sad, but I do understand. I'm staying at the Ambassador, and I'll be here until this evening. If you change your mind, leave a message.
I won't change my mind. He looked at her. As much as I'd like to.
Nancy squeezed his hand. I'm sorry I disturbed you by coming back into your life. But I wanted you to know that I never got over you, Paul. And I never will.
Nancy didn't look at him as she walked back toward the edge of the park. But he looked at her. And once again, Paul Hood was standing alone. Two movie tickets in his wallet. Suffering the absence of a woman he loved.